This next gentleman, of course, again, three-time All-Star from the MLB Network. Had him back. We actually replayed the segment on our 125th show edition 3 episodes ago because we enjoyed it so much. We wanted to single out something that was an example of a segment we really enjoyed between the 100 and 125th episodes, and that was the one we chose. That was just a lot of fun the last time we had him on. Actually, it was the night of Roy Halladay's no-hitter in the playoffs. So pleased to bring him back in. The mayor, Sean Casey, to the FDH Lounge. Sean, good to have you back in, my man. Merry Christmas, Happy New Year. How's it going with you?
Great to be back on, and Merry Christmas, Happy New Year to you guys, too. You know, I got my 4 kids. It's so great when you have little kids and you start to really realize that Christmas is awesome and Santa's back and all that good stuff. So this has been a fun time.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's got to be great with the family around and everything, and what a great time of year. I understand that the FDH New York Bureau, Mr. Servillo here, had a little bet with you going a couple weeks ago here that if the Jets were able to get it going at Pittsburgh here, which they've never done in their entire freaking history before, but if they were able to do it, that we'd get you back on pretty quickly here. You were at that game. You were shivering and probably in disbelief at the outcome there. The first time in the history of the franchise the Jets get it done there.
It was unbelievable. I mean, Steve's texting me the whole game. I'm like, please let them pull us out, just, you know, just so I can throw it back in Steve's face. And he keeps texting me, and the next thing I know, the Jets lost, and now I'm back on with you guys. But I love being back on with you guys. I don't mind it. I did mind that the Steelers lost, and it was freezing cold sitting out there watching it.
Yeah, I hope that I hope that wasn't the excuse that was needed to get you back on here, but no, that was...
No, it wasn't. I had such a blast last time again. I'd come on whenever you guys want me to.
Well, I'll tell you what, too, and just to let you know, we've also put together, and this will be probably in some rotation here on STN, our highlight reel, sort of our ultimate clip show of the first 125 episodes plus. 36 segments from the course of all of the shows, averaging out to about a minute or two apiece. One of the segments on there is you with Tim Faust, our other lounge dignitary there, when you were telling him he should not be general manager of the Indians for keeping Matt Wieters at the expense of Buster Posey and Carlos Santana in our keeper league. That was one of our all-time great moments right there, Sean.
Well, I love it. I'm glad I can make one of your top segments of the year.
We enjoyed it. That was a lot of fun. As far as things to be shivering your yam off at Heinz Field there, are you going to be out there for the Winter Classic on Saturday?
Yeah, I am. You know what? I got season tickets to the Penguins, but I don't go to all the games, but I go to a few of the games, and one of the perks is that you get the chance to get a shot at the Winter Classic. So, yeah, I'm going to be out there. We're going down with a good buddy of mine, and really looking forward to it.
Okay. Now,
they say it's going to be 50 and maybe rainy, though.
Yeah.
That wouldn't be good.
Yeah, that is going to be really something. That's you know, I enjoy watching that every year on TV, channel surfing while all the bowl games are on, and it's quickly gotten to be a part of a fabric of the day. Now, I've been to the old Igloo, not to watch hockey, but I'd been there, and you're going to love this, 98 King of the Ring, the Mick Foley moment. So I was there for that. So I know firsthand what a dump the old Igloo is. Compare and contrast with the new place, since you say you got Penguin season tickets.
Well, you know what, the consulate said, they really did it right. I mean, anybody that comes, you know, to that facility would say, man, they didn't leave any stone unturned. They really did it right. It's all first class. All the seats are good. It's just a great place. There's great food. But like, more than anything, the arena is really nice. I love the Igloo. I'm in Mountain Arena. We love that place. Obviously, it goes down in the lures of history here in Pittsburgh for some great moments. And the 98 King of the Ring was one of them. But it was, the Console Energy Center is really an awesome place. And, you know, for all the people there in Cleveland that only have to make a 2-hour drive to come here and check out a game and watch a really awesome hockey team, it'd be worth it.
Well, you know, the times when I'm in Pittsburgh, I got to tell you, when I'm wearing my Wings jersey, I don't get received so well. So,
yeah, you know what? They don't like the Detroit, the Red Wings too much around here.
My hero, Sean, there's a guy, and he's actually from Cleveland. This was during the finals. I don't remember if it was an 08 or an 09, because they said they were going to toss out anybody that was chucking the octopi on the ice. Dude chucks one out there during the pregame introductions. They escort him out. He goes out to the parking lot, takes off his jersey. He's wearing another one underneath. He's got a second ticket in the car, goes back in, watches the game anyways. He's my hero.
Now that's the way to do it. Now, that's planning ahead right there, Rick.
That's how you got to roll, man. That's you know, for anybody like me that loves the Wings, I certainly respect something like that. But I got to tell you, too, with it being the small world, the increasingly small world of people who've been on the lounge, your boy, your office mate there, I guess the deputy mayor, Tom Verducci, over at the MLB Network and Sports Illustrated, I'm holding it up for the camera here. I got this sweet Sports Illustrated baseball book, coffee table book from my family at Christmas, and I'm opening up like, introduction, Tom Verducci. Holy crap, we had him on the show.
No, hey, he's big time. I thought I was big time until I went to MLB Network and realized Tom Verducci's really big time. You know, he wrote the Joe Torre book, and he's wrote a ton of good things, and he's the number one writer there at Sports Illustrated. So the fact that he was on your show, Rick, makes you big time, brother.
Thank you. Thank you. By association, I'll take that, Sean. I'll take the reflected glory. And it was a lot of fun. It was fun breaking the stuff down with him and getting his takes on everything that had happened. And, you know, I'd like to get some of your thoughts on some of the things we talked about that, Tom, with, and get your perspective on this. The whole thing with the Giants winning the World Series this year, the point of view that I come at it from is they look like a team that did it almost before their time, almost maybe like if Arizona had done it, if they'd gone all the way in 07. Now, the funny thing is Arizona never put it together afterwards. They came close, but, you know, that year, haven't done it since. But the Giants, geez, you know, Buster Posey's only a rookie. These pitchers are all still very young, arguably all still on the upward slope out of that young core of the pitchers. You got some bad money that's going to be coming off the books in the next year or two. You know, Renteria right now, Rowand soon enough. I mean, this is a team where, and we had on Mad Dog Russo a couple weeks ago, and he's a big Giants fan. I said to him, I said, not to be a buzzkill, but you got to do it again or it's going to be a letdown, right? I mean, it's, you know, this is a team, Sean, where if they don't do it again after this, they're going to go down as an underachieving team because they got the core to do it again, especially with the money they'll be able to add.
Well, they got the core to do it again. I think the big thing for them, Rick, was that they peaked at the right time, and they had struggled offensively. Freddie Sanchez was down with an injury. They had a lot of guys down. Buster Posey wasn't even up yet. They end up trading Molina, bring Posey up. That's when things started to really happen. But they got Pat Burrell out there sitting on his couch, gets released by Tampa, you know, having some chips and a couple cold ones. Next thing you know, he's with the Giants, and he's hitting bombs and really becomes a main clog in the middle of that lineup. So, I mean, that was a big addition. Aubrey Huff had a great year. Their offense really started to click a little bit and get going, and then the pitching said, you know what, we got a little offense, we're starting to get a couple runs here, and now you got Lincecum, and you got Kane, and you got Baumgartner, and you got Sanchez, and you just got guys, and Brian Wilson in the back end of that pen, the bullpen, they go and get Javi Lopez from the Pirates. It was just everything happened at the right time for the San Francisco Giants this year at the right time. You know, August, September, they just kept getting better, and it showed. They rolled through the playoffs because they became a great team finally.
Well, this is the thing about them here, and a lot of times I get kind of weird takes and weird perspectives, so you won't hurt my feelings if you tell me that this is another one of them. But in looking at that team, Aubrey Huff, Pat Burrell, some of the key guys in there, even Cody Ross to a certain extent. What it seemed like to me was they got all of these guys to be everything they could be at the same moment. Aubrey Huff, over the course of his career, sometimes he's the guy who can be an all-star. Sometimes he comes up way short of that. Pat Burrell, he had a good thing going in Philly there for most of the time he was there. And when he went to Tampa Bay, not so much, but he looked like the old Pat Burrell. Essentially, it seemed like they had guys who they all had the potential in them. Most of them had flashed it at some point or another, but they all sort of became that best version of themselves at the same time, it seemed like.
No, I think you hit the nail right on the head. I mean, I think when Pat Burrell came over, well, what are we getting here? The guy just hit 205 or whatever he hit in Tampa, not many home runs, swinging through a lot of fastballs that he usually hammers. What are you getting? Well, what are you getting? You get, you know, close to 20 home runs, you know, he's coming up with big hits down the stretch. So, bam, you get the Pat Burrell you thought you were getting. Aubrey Huff comes out. Is he going to be the guy that does all right, or is he going to be the Silver Slugger Award winner? Well, bam, you got the Silver Slugger Award winner. He comes out, starts drinking. Cody Ross, you get him in his deal. What does he turn out to be? He gets hot when he needs needs to get hot and comes up with some huge home runs against the Phillies and just really, you know, kickstarts that lineup in the championship series. And then next thing you know, they're in the World Series. So, yeah, you got the perfect storm of those guys really clicking at the right time. Freddie Sanchez, shoulder starts feeling good right about end of August. You know, I covered the World Series down there, so I was on the field with a lot of those guys for MLB Network during the time and talking to Bruce Bochy. He's like, you know what? Freddie's just starting to get healthy, right? At the end of August, beginning of September, it was almost like adding another bat. So everything happened so perfectly for those guys at the right time. Lincecum struggled in August, dominated in September. I mean, you know, it was just like everything started coming together for him.
Well, and in terms of the future and in terms of looking at what they've got there, I'd like to get your thoughts on this and compare your answer to what I got from Tom when he was on. He seemed to sort of differ from my premise on this. I looked at it, and maybe it's just a surface perspective on my part, but Philadelphia, it is a large market per se. It was not regarded as such in the baseball sense until the core of the great infielders came along and, you know, everything that they've done over the last 8 years or so, you know, and now they are an actual large market team, the way they're throwing money around and everything like that. It strikes me that San Francisco, I mean, the Bay Area is what, the fifth or sixth biggest market in the country if you take, you know, the big cities collectively there. I mean, San Francisco never should be regarded as a small or even medium market team, but they kind of have been because of circumstance over time. Do they have the perspective essentially to grow the same way Philadelphia did? You're going to have a lot of fans who are even more enthused, who are buying world championship merchandise, plowing fan money back into the team and everything like that. Do the Giants have a chance to grow organizationally and be able to go and attract better players in the same way that Philadelphia has been able to do?
I think so. Whenever you have the success the Giants had this year with winning the World Series, the excitement in that city, man, that city was, you know, I thought there was going to be a huge riot there, the way they were so excited and partying and just having a great time. And that's when you build the fan interest. That's when money starts coming in, more revenue. I think they're still a little leery of the contract they gave to Barry Zito, how they went out and they said, oh, we're going to get this one big starting pitcher, and then now they're stuck with it. You know, I think you know, Brian Sabian takes a step back a little bit more now after seeing that contract and realizing, you know, sometimes those big going out to get a guy you might think is the best player on the market and pay him that huge amount of sum of money straps you in the long run. So I think they definitely have the recipe, though, right now to ride the wave of the World Series, all the success they had, to go to another level where they can start keeping that young nucleus of pitchers together, Brian Wilson in the back end of the pen, and get a good, good solid team gathered around Buster Posey.
Yeah. I mean, clearly that's the benchmark for them. I think they're going to be regarded as underachievers if it's one and done, especially since, as we said, arguably they did it before their time, essentially. They did it before they were as good as they're likely to be on paper in the near future. When you look at it, another thing that just strikes me also, Sean, and I go back to this, I mean, you when you were coming up, you know, you had the cup of coffee with the great Indians teams, you know, in the late 90s before, as we covered on the last show, before they unwisely moved you as they did. But it's weird because, you know, somebody like me, I grew up a Tribe fan, and I'm looking at that, I'm like, oh, okay, this is it. This is how it happens. This is how the drought ends. And the drought didn't end at that time. Meanwhile, you go to what Boston did in 04 and what the Giants did this year. I mean, Boston, things were so iffy with them, they end up moving Noma at the trading deadline that year. I don't think at that point in time you could have pegged them for this is the year that the 1918 thing goes away. The Giants this year, you know, they were battling San Diego down to the last day of the season. You know, this is just a couple of instances here, but boy, sometimes it seems like these historic droughts get broken when you least expect it, not when you most expect it.
No, I think you're right. And I think you look back at some of the teams, you look back at the Indians and the runs that they made, and you thought to yourself, all right, they're getting rid of a lot of them, their minor league guys. What's the future going to look like? Well, John Hart did it right. I think the people are looking at the models that John Hart did back then when they were signing Manny Ramirez and signing Kenny Lofton and Carlos Baerga and all these young guys, Sandy Alomar Jr., to these long-term contracts, saying, listen, we got some great players in trades. We've developed some great players. We need to keep decide which guys we need to keep. We need to get a great farm system going where we can make trades and keep this going for years at a time. And I think you start to look at the Giants and people they're drafting, and that's what they're gonna have to do too. You got to get the guys like Buster Posey and the Tim Lincecums and the Matt Cains and the Madison Bumgarners and say, you know what, you're our future. We're gonna lock you up long term. We're gonna keep drafting well. And when it's time for those guys to make some more money, maybe when we need to go get a piece or something, we can trade this guy or trade that guy and go get a piece and still win championships. So that's how clubs end up, clubs keep winning year in and year out.
And it's one of these things too, Sean. I mean, I look at things a lot of times through the eyes of a writer. I mean, maybe I'm just taking the surface view of it, but it really seems fitting, just in the classic sense here, that the Giants win the World Series, because we were talking about it with you when you were on previously. Again, coincidentally, you were on the night of Halliday's no-hitter in the playoffs, which just, again, tended to exemplify this whole trend, year of the pitcher. But if you go back to 2009, we were seeing it, even then with the perfect game and no-hitters and everything like that. It's the way that the game has been building and shaping over the last year or two, and maybe subtly even a little bit further back than that, almost kind of fitting that a team that would be the poster child for this new Major League Baseball ends up winning the World Series this year.
Isn't that the truth? You know, the San Fran, they don't have enough offense. You know what? The bottom line is, at the end of the day, when you get to the postseason, great pitching shuts down great hitting. That's the bottom line. So if you can scrap out a couple runs, you get a hanging cutter from Cliffley to Renteria to get a 3-run homer out of it. That's all those guys need. You know, look, you go back and look at Lincecum in Game 5. I could have told you after the second pitch of the game, no one's scoring off this guy tonight. I mean, he just had that nasty slider, splitter, whatever he wants to call it. I mean, he calls it a slider. He holds it like a splitter. I don't know what it is, but it rides left, it sinks, it cuts, it's nasty. And, you know, at the end of the day, that shuts down anybody. You know, you put Tony Gwynn up there 9 times, it's going to shut him down. I mean, great hitters, great pitchers shuts down great hitting, and I think we saw that this year with the Giants where we said, you know what, that pitching is going to win out at the end of the day, and it did.
Yeah. Yeah, they made it happen, and it was really incredible in the way that they did. And it, again, is, you know, no pun intended, sort of like an arms race that they've kicked off here in the National League as the Phillies. Boy, I mean, if we thought it was an epic National League Championship Series this past year, matching arm against arm, what the heck would it look like if it was a rematch in 2011? Coming in at the 11th hour, blowing everybody out of the water here. On the Cliff Lee thing, what are your thoughts on that? It's something that really has the potential to reshape baseball in the sense that, for once, I mean, even the Yankees are now scrapping for pitching, and even the Yankees are like, oh, darn, Ricky Nolasco is not available. I mean, when's the last time the Yankees were ever PO'd? They couldn't get their paws on a Ricky Nolasco. This thing's really been a game changer.
Oh, really? Yeah, and kudos to Cliff Lee for saying, you know what, I loved Philly, I want to pitch there, that's where I want to go. I mean, and you saw, when he got traded to Seattle, he was blindsided. You know, he thought, oh, I thought we were about to sign an extension, I really like it here, I love the fans, I love my teammates. So you almost felt like, well, if they have a chance to get him back, it'd be interesting to see if he bites on it, and he did. You know, he did, because, hey, he got his $125 million or whatever, and he gets a chance to be in that rotation with Halliday, with Hamels, with Oswald. I mean, that's an unbelievable thing. You know, a four-headed monster they got going on right there. As Steve would say, the four horsemen with the PH. I love that, you know. I love that, the four horsemen. But and it's true. I mean, you know, you got to love how that matchup. I mean, can you imagine that matchup when you go back to the playoffs? Now you got the Lincecum, the Kane, Bumgarner, Sanchez, those guys, you know, matching up against that, you know, the four horsemen out there in Philly. So, I mean, and it was awesome for Cliff Lee to send a statement, too, to say, you know what, you don't have to go to, you know, New York. Go where you want to be happy, and the money is still there. Was still a ton of money given to him, and like you said too, Rick, I mean, after CeCe Sabathia, what do the Yankees really have right now? I mean, what's Pettit, you know, gonna be or gonna end up doing? You know, is Phil Hughes gonna be able to come back and repeat what he did this year? Or, you know, in parts of the year he struggled a little bit. I mean, they have a lot of question marks in their rotation. And you got the Red Sox who said, you know what, we're gonna make sure we make the playoffs next year and go get Carl Crawford and trade for Adrian Gonzalez, sign Bobby Jenks at the back end of that pen. I mean, they've done some things to make themselves better. So, you know, you're right though. The Yankees aren't getting some of the players that they usually would.
Well, you know what? It's a thing where I guess this is parity in 2011 MLB style, where parity means that any one of six or seven teams can win the World Series. But yeah, you know, there's a number of them at that level now, you know, that all have the chance really to do it, it seems. I want to get your thoughts also, too. Your boy Tom Verducci, he wrote an excellent column, and I think it came out just before this whole free agent flurry started and the guys started signing. Essentially, this whole notion, and I've believed it in a long time myself, of where the best player available on the market, especially if it's a down year in terms of talent, is going to make out like a bandit, and expectations are going to be for them to be more than they are. And I don't know if we've ever seen a better example of that than Jason Wirth. For the numbers that he's put up historically, what he's going to be expected to do in Washington is patently unrealistic given what he's done before. We can go on down the line here, even to somebody like Carl Crawford, and maybe it's the fantasy geek in me, but I look at a guy who's never really developed the kind of power in his game. The doubles have never really become the home runs on the level that we all thought. On and on and on. It just seems like being in the right place at the right time is going to get you a lot of money, but could be a setup for bad expectations and everything later on, like what happened to Carl Pavano a few years ago. And examples of that, I think, have been legion.
Yeah, well, you know, I think those guys at the end of the day can take a little ribbon to take home $120 million. You know, if they end up stinking, they say, you know what, I'm laughing all the way to the bank in 7 years. If I stink, you're not even going to remember who I am, but I got $140 million in my bank account, you know? That's what they think. Yeah, you know what? I think that Jason Worth contract is going to come back to haunt the Nationals. I really do. I think Jason Worth's a good big league ball player. I don't think he's that contract of a ball player. They had Adam Dunn sitting there who puts up 40 homers and drives at 110 runs every year. You got him sitting there. He wants to come back to Washington for God knows why. They don't sign him back, but they sign a guy like Jason Worth. I mean, I think Jason Worth is a good big league ball player. I just don't think he's worth that kind of money. I always look back to when the Cubs signed Milton Brawley to 3 years, $30 million. I'm thinking, does anyone doing their homework? Does anyone not see they know something I don't know and that everyone else in the league doesn't know about these guys? And I think you end up signing guys like that. Like we talked about the Giants, they signed Zito, where that straps you for years to come with signing other free agents, and I think Washington might be doing that with themselves with signing a guy like Jason Worth.
Agree completely. The difference with New York is they can afford to pay these guys that. It's almost sort of built in a little bit of this waste into the system because they can afford it. Jason Worth, boy, yeah, the expectations are going to be crushing. He's probably not going to live up to them, and yeah, he can afford solid gold earplugs, though, to get rid of the booze, though, Sean. You know?
Exactly. Yeah, and you're right, too, Rick. You know, even with Boston, they can afford to, Mike Lowell doesn't pan out or whatever, they go get Adrian Beltre. Mike Lowell's making $12 million a year as a bench player. Well, yeah. Teams like Boston and New York can eat those contracts. Other teams, it ends up strapping you for years.
Yeah, it makes me sick as an Indians fan. I mean, like when Rocco Baldelli went to Boston a few years ago, I'm going, I would kill for the friggin' Dolans to shell out to get a Rocco Baldelli to play the outfield full time. He's going to be like their fifth outfielder, you know?
Right. He's going to be a guy that plays every once in a while and then platoon role.
Yeah. That stuff. Yeah, it's at least I can laugh about it, but in a very bitter sense, I suppose.
I got a question for you, Rick. What was your feeling? I know you've probably already covered this and you guys have gone down that road, but I got to hear your feeling on the whole feeling about LeBron James and, now that it's all played out, the Heat's doing well, Cleveland's struggling. Where's your feeling on that?
You know what? It's one of those things where, I'm obviously conflicted on the subject because, again, I didn't like a lot of the jersey burning and stuff like that. Not because I didn't come to loathe the guy, because I did, because I think he really revealed a lot of things about himself. He was like Tony Soprano, the way he took from this organization and put his boys on the payroll and everything like that. And, just the way that he did it in the end with no class. But I almost felt like he was sitting back and able to laugh at Cleveland from all the jerks that were out in the streets burning the jerseys. I almost felt like this town lost its sense of dignity with it. Everybody was so much into hating the guy. I would have liked to have seen hate with a little more dignity, I guess, if I could classify it that way.
You get Dan Gilbert coming out and kind of, getting all over him too the way he did. My wife's family's from Cleveland, so I always talk to my brother-in-law. I always ask him, how's it going? You're still mad at LeBron? And I think he says the same thing. He was more upset about the way it was done than anything.
Yeah, exactly. And if he wasn't going to go, I think he probably should have done a little bit more to let the organization know that. It sounds like his bags were packed 2-3 years ago, and I just would have appreciated him being a little more upfront. It would have been a real almost unimaginable situation to see them trading him, but I would have rather seen something that would have prepared the organization better than this, rather than him allowing them until the 11th hour to put all their eggs in that basket. They only fired Mike Brown because he hated him. You know, I mean, to the very end, you know, he allowed this team to do that, move in that direction, allowed them to think they had a chance when they really never did. I mean, I'll tell you, though, I mean, I am kind of like a turn-the-page kind of a guy, though. I mean, my philosophy is, okay, what are we going to do about it? I mean, a perfect example of that, Sean, the very next day on our blog, I was like, okay, here's some trade scenarios. Here's what we can do. Here's how we can get Chris Paul and Al Jefferson, you know? So by Friday afternoon, by the day after it, Sean, I'm not saying I wasn't pissed, but I was like, how are we going to get back? You know what I mean? Right. And I wish the organization would do the same. We had Mike Molesky and the director of new media sales the last show here, because they've really done some great progressive things in the new media era. You can tell that Dan Gilbert is a good friend of Mark Cuban, because they both operate with a lot of the new media and social media platforms, and it's fascinating stuff that they're doing. But he and I disagree on this point. I said to him, I said, blow it up. Blow it up yesterday. You know, tank again. Let's go get this, Terrence Jones, I guess is his name, from Kentucky. Let's go get him, you know, with a lottery pick, you know. So I'm in favor of, you know, whatever it takes to get back as soon as possible, understanding that's a long process. A lot of other people are not so, you know, there's still a lot of people in this town that are like chickens with their heads caught off, though, Sean. I mean, there's a lot of people that are just really PO'd. And the night that it happened, too, I got to tell you, you know, just it was despicable, all the fraternization and everything like that. Now, you've been a big league ball player, and I understand that there's things you have bonds and friendships that cross lines of franchises and stuff, but you know, Booby Gibson was upset, and I've been a huge Booby Gibson fan for a long time, thought he was underutilized. I tweeted at him that I was disappointed about his demeanor. He tweeted back at a bunch of people, you know, I guess because he was getting this, so he addressed this basically to everybody, how disappointed it, or basically that we should give him the benefit of the doubt. And I tweeted back and I said, Booby, it looked like you wanted to spoon with LeBron at midcourt. Can you understand why we're pissed about that?
Right. No, I see that too. You're exactly right. I mean, and I think you have to take into account all the fans, all the people that put in, you know, that Cleveland was finally the best team in the NBA record-wise, and they finally, you know, were going to get their shot to, you know, get that championship, and that, you know, they just get their legs cut out from under them. And listen, I was in South Beach a couple weeks ago with some friends of mine, and we ended up going to a Heat game, and I can honestly say I watched about a minute and a half of it, and then I went up to the Doers Club and kind of just hung out and had some nachos and whatever. I didn't really watch the game, but at the beginning of the game, no one was in the stands. That's what they said. They're having problems getting the people in the stands at the beginning of the games. And I just feel like the passion in Cleveland for those fans, that if LeBron would have won it in Cleveland, for what those fans brought and how he would have been a legendary status, they could have held him up as the king forever in that city that wants a championship so bad. And now he's in Miami. He's, you know, he's playing second fiddle to Dwayne Wade. I just really believe, like, wow, I feel like that's a big mistake he made, because all those fans loved him there for the simple reason they're blue-collar people, and they wanted to see a local kid from Akron, you know, come in and win a championship there.
Exactly. You know, and as a sports historian, or some might say sports nerd, but, you know, I can tell you, nobody's ever given up the chance to be the greatest in their sport. There's nobody who, if you can look at the major sports, there's nobody who's been on a glide path to potentially number one of all time who said, you know what, screw it, I'd rather go ride this guy's jock to some titles. Nobody's ever done that, Sean.
Yeah, I know. And you look at the guys, like, you know, Barkley was making the point about, you know, he'll never be that Michael Jordan now, because Michael Jordan, you know, took the Bulls when they stunk. Scottie Pippen came along, and they, you know, became, you know, one of the greatest teams ever. He probably is one of the greatest players of all time. But, you know, he didn't go jump ship and try and go to the Lakers and, you know, be with Magic Johnson, or go to the Celtics and hang out with Bird. He was like, we're going to win it here. We're going to win it in Chicago. And we're going to do it because I'm a winner. And that's what LeBron was.
Well, you know what, and I'll tell you what, he'll always be one ring short of Dwayne Wade, unless, I'll tell you what, if they get that first title, if I was Dwayne Wade, I wouldn't walk in front of it near any buses with LeBron around, because if he gets hit by a bus, that's the only way LeBron's catching him. So, D-Wade, watch your back. It's not like LeBron doesn't have enough character to throw you in front of that bus, because, you know, he certainly does have the lack right there on that. as far as outsized personalities, trash talk, things like that, I guess that's a good segue. It's always fun to talk pro wrestling with you. And certainly the New York Bureau had some things he wanted me to find out from you. Any of these things that come to mind here, first wrestling card you saw live or favorite jobbers? Let's start in those areas there.
First wrestling card I ever saw live, I remember I was in the Mellon Arena, as we talked about, you know, Civic Arena back then. I think I was in like fourth grade, and I still remember making a sign. It was like Sergeant Slaughter versus Jimmy Superfly Snuka in a cage. And I remember making my sister and I making signs that said Sergeant Slaughter's in deep water when Jimmy Superfly Snuka's around. And I held up the sign. There was no WWE Raw on stuff, but I was so proud of that sign. I was so proud of to be there at the Civic Arena with that match, and Superfly Snuka came off the top of the cage, I think. And I can still remember it being one of the greatest things. And like, looking back, I remember Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff talking to like a really good looking female in the crowd. Like in the crowd, it was like kind of weird. He was in his tights and everything like that, and I was like, isn't that Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff there? But I was in fourth grade, so I really didn't get it back then. But it was I still remember that match, and I remember Andre the Giant fought Iron Mike Sharp. Remember him, Iron Mike Sharp?
Yeah, with the arm.
He wore like the black wristband or whatever. And I remember slapping Andre the Giant, man. He was just so big. I remember my hand hitting his belly. It was just like, you know, just like he was already sweating bullets.
Yeah, exactly. That really was something with Andre, with everything that he could do there. What were some of your favorite jobbers? That was another thing Steve was wondering. On the last show, we talked the Mulkey brothers, Mike Jackson, the Alabama Junior Heavyweight Champion. Anybody else come to mind? Mike Sharp was kind of a jobber.
I mean, some of my favorite jobbers. I don't know. I'd have to. What are some of your favorite jobbers? I'd have to think about that.
Let's see. The Duke of Dorchester. That was a pretty good one. Back in the day, he seemed to be on primetime wrestling a lot, like especially the
right.
Boston Garden cards. He was on there. Don't sleep on Thunderfoot number one and two. Cruel Connection. See, I'm partial to TBS because that was the crap I grew up on.
Right.
So Superstation.
What about? I mean, I was just talking about, what about like your Iron Mike Sharps? I mean, that was a guy everyone was always like, you know, Iron Mike Sharp. He was kind of like the guy you think he was going to win, but then he ended up getting dominated. You know, you're like, okay, this guy's going to finally win one, and he would just end up getting killed. He was one. What about Barry O? Remember Barry O?
Barry O. I'm making the O to the camera right now above my head.
He'd get crushed. There was always some good ones. I mean, didn't Teddy Long used to wrestle a little bit before? Wasn't he one of the guys who would just get crushed in the ring too?
No, he was a ref. He was a ref.
Okay, all right, yeah.
Remember,
there was another guy back that reminded me of Teddy Long, and I just can't remember his name back in the NWA. But
what, Ranger Ross, perhaps? not Ranger Ross. Oh, George South, he was a great jobber.
Oh, George South was awesome. George South, he was on every WTBS. He was always there.
Yeah. George South was really good. There were some excellent ones from back in the day. And as fun as the old territories were.
Too, there's not as many jobbers now as there was back in the day. You know, now it's like, now every match is like a big match and everything like that. You know, back in the day, you got Tony Schiavone and those guys. So we got to go. You know, we finally got the Road Warriors versus Arn Anderson and Tully Blanchard at the Omni in Atlanta, and they had to go. We were watching jobbers the whole match for the last 2 hours.
Isn't it great, though, the stuff you can dial up on YouTube, especially the old Georgia Championship stuff? That is, I mean, there's stuff from like before my time, because I don't remember the stuff with the Freebirds from the early 80s. That was a little bit before me. But to see the angles they did with Tommy Rich and Ted DiBiase and stuff, awesome.
You guys sent me that stuff, Ole Anderson, you know, the Ole Anderson book I'm reading right now, which is unbelievable. But you go back to those, you know, the TBS days where they'd come on the studio and the Road Warriors would charge a ring in their jeans and all that stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, that was wrestling to me, you know, when you go back to those WTBS, you know, Superstation days when they had that little, you know, the little studio wrestling.
Yeah, that was some great stuff. I know there have been some indies here and there that have done. I think the NWA was doing some tapings out of like a studio in Hollywood, but it's hard to evoke that time, you know. I mean, you could try and do it in like a retro kind of a way, but it's hard to go back to that. But I can't help but think that might be part of a subsequent wave, you know, that maybe in some ways some promotion will do that. And the way that it's kind of flattening out too with internet stuff, that, you know, we were talking about that with Jerry Lawler when he was on his promotion, and I guess he folded it, but it is able to be seen worldwide, which was different from when he was coming up in the business and running that promotion and everything like that. So, you know, the way it's going with the internet in the next couple of years here, you know, maybe Raw, you know, maybe TNA, maybe they'll get run down by some of these other ones if you give it 5-10 years or whatever, and maybe that studio thing will come back into fashion.
Well, you see the Ring of Honor. I don't know if you watch that at all.
Yeah,
the Ring of Honor. That's a little, you know, almost like an ECW feel, kind of a smaller venue. Then, you know, the smaller. I'm going down in a couple weeks with a buddy of mine who's a guy named Marty Miller, who's a cameraman guy for WWE. He's helping directing some shows for Florida Championship Wrestling. And Dusty Rhodes is the kind of the booker down there. So I'm heading down there in a couple weeks to. They want me to be the guest announcer. But I know my buddy Marty. He's like a total snake. That if I guest announce, someone's gonna come out and, you know, throw a haymaker on me. And the next thing you know, I got mayhem. So I'm like, I'm not going out there if you're gonna you know, pull one over on me. I don't need that.
Well, you know, it was tremendous. Like about maybe 2 weeks, I want to say, after we had you on. We had on a reunion. We had of the original Midnight Express. We had on Condry and Eaton, and it turns out Dennis Condry was working with the Nexus guys down in Florida. There, I didn't even realize that till he came on. But he was helping to train all of those guys right before they came up for the reality show that they were doing there. So that was tremendous to you know, they were getting the old school influence of a Dennis Condry.
I mean, you think about them, you know, Midnight Express. You think about just all those, you know, Dennis Condry and what he brings, and Bobby Eaton and those guys, and what they, you know, I think a lot of those guys feel like the respect factor, and then times have changed with some of these younger guys. But, you know, for guys like Nexus and those guys to get that, you know, old school feel of this is what it was like. You know, I'm reading these books of Arn Anderson, Ole Anderson, even Hogan, DiBiase, those guys that came up in a time when, you know, when it was really, you know, really had to pay your dues to kind of move up. And now you got these guys on Nexus who maybe, you know, wrestled for a few years and they get on this show, and next thing you know, they're you know, one of the main events on Raw. So it's just, you know, how the times have changed.
Exactly. Yeah, it really is pretty far out there. Well, I'll leave you with this, Sean. This is something that I didn't get a chance to tell this to Dennis when he was on. Hopefully he would have laughed, and hopefully the next time he's on he will laugh. But I had seen a description of him on a wrestling message board, that the look that he had back in the day was that of somebody who sold foot fetish magazines out of a van at the flea market.
Oh, that's great. I don't know if that's the greatest description to have for yourself.
That's an effective heel character, if nothing else.
Yeah, that's great.
But Sean, you know, take a chance here, plug away on stuff, whether it be Labels Are for Jars, whether it be the Field project you got going on there. Please take it away and, you know, let the viewers know anything they should know about any of that.
Well, we have a great project we're trying to do here called, and it's under Casey's Clubhouse, and you can go to caseysclubhouse.org and check it out. But we're trying to build a Miracle League field for disabled and special needs kids out here in the South Hills of Pennsylvania, and it's a wonderful, wonderful project, and we're looking to raise $1 million. But anyone can donate and help us out. If you go to caseysclubhouse.org, and if you could just watch that video, there's a video on there from Brian Gumbel did and Frank DeFore did on HBO Sports about 8 years ago, and it's on the website. And I'll tell you, that video really kind of opens up your doors or your heart to, you know, what's going on with America League and how awesome of a project it is. So if you could check that out, Rick, and I appreciate you letting me plug that, but if you could check that out and some of your viewers could check it out, it's really a great thing. And you can, you know, if you want to donate $1 or $100 or whatever you want to, you know, you can go do it online there. Steve donated a couple bucks. Thanks a lot, Steve.
Yep.
Appreciate that, brother.
Yep, Steve is the man. I will have some coming your way too here, and I appreciate you know, what you're doing there. We are always happy to get to plug that. God bless you for giving back, Sean, and, you know, we're really in the spirit of the holidays here with Merry Christmas and Happy New Year and everything. But thank you so much, my man. It was great to have you back in, Mr. Mayor, and the next time we do it can't be soon enough.
Hey, Rick, thanks a ton, man. I really appreciate it. It's always fun being on and going through some different topics and talking some wrestling and some stuff, and looking forward to doing it again, brother. Tell Steve I said hi, too.
It's awesome. Thank you so much, Sean.
I will. Right, I'll talk to you, Rick. Thanks, buddy.